If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA Playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA Playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Since the reign of Queen Victoria, the British monarchy have had a complex and often murky relationship with the intelligence services. It's a relationship that Richard J. Aldrich and Rory Cormack dissect in their new book, The Secret Royals. They spoke to BBC History Revealed staff writer Emma Slattery-Williams. And the first voice you'll hear is Richard's.
Your book, The Secret Royals, looks at the relationship between the British monarchy and the intelligence service from the reign of Queen Victoria. How involved in intelligence had monarchs been before Queen Victoria?
So perhaps the most famous monarch come spymaster was Elizabeth I. And to some extent, she's often credited with creating the modern intelligence community. There's often this idea that the kind of intelligence community we have now was replicated or originated to fight the Spanish Armada, but actually it was rather different. What we see under Elizabeth is these sort of private fiefdoms. We often see Elizabeth's intelligence as being associated with a figure called Walsingham. Actually, Elizabeth had about four or five spy chiefs. They were all running these things like private businesses, and they were all fighting like rats in a sack.
So, Rory, I'll put this question to you. I believe it was an assassination attempt in 1840 that ignited Victoria's personal interest in espionage and led to the establishment of the modern intelligence service. Could you tell us a bit more about that, please?
It was. She comes onto the throne at a young age. She's led a very sheltered childhood, but she does start to take some instructions, some lessons from her uncle, the King of the Belgians, King Leopold, in some of the darker arts of statecraft. One particularly interesting thing that he taught her was about deception and telling her that her enemies and friends will always intercept her letters. So if she wants to try and mislead them, then she should put a little lie or something else in the in the envelope and try to deceive them. So she started to get a bit of an interest in it, but it wasn't until the attempted assassination in 1840 when this really takes off, because intelligence is about keeping monarchs safe. It's not just about informing policy or whatever. It has a very personal role for the sovereign. And she takes a obsessive, almost macabre interest in this. So it's 1840. She and Albert are coming down Constitution Hill in their carriage. They hear a gunshot, and there's a scuffle, and eventually a young man is arrested. But the very next day, Victoria goes out and starts to look for bullet holes in the wall, and she starts to play forensic detective. She's grilling the Home Secretary on the latest intelligence. She wants to know who this man is, who he's working for. Is there a secret society, a continental-style secret society behind this? And she wants to know about directions that bullets travel. She wants to know what the latest material is, the latest secret intelligence. And she's pestering her Home Secretary. She's pestering the Prime Minister about this. And as we know, this was the first of many attempts on her life. And each time she took the intelligence very, very seriously. There was another occasion where she found out that there was a man who wanted to kill her. And then she used herself as bait. She and Albert went out very bravely, to be fair to them, went out driving around their carriage with a policeman watching from the shadows, using herself as bait to try and draw this gunman back out from the crowd. So she was quite brave, and it did form a lifelong fascination with intelligence and secrecy and the dark arts of international statecraft.
And exactly as Rory said, this is to some extent the foundation of the secret state. When Victoria comes to the throne, there's no real detective department in the Metropolitan Police. By the time she completes her reign at the end of the 19th century, there's a special branch with 600 people. Much of this is the response to threats to the royal person. What we see with this figure, particularly Edward Oxford, the person who tries to kill Victoria in 1840, is growing anxiety about revolutionaries, anarchists, Chartists, these sorts of people. Victoria is particularly fixated about this political threat, but actually most of the people who attack Victoria are lone individuals who sadly are suffering from mental health problems.
So I believe that Victoria got her daughter, Princess Victoria Vicky, to become a spy in the Prussian court. How did that come about, and what information was she sending back to Britain?
She was sending all sorts of really juicy stuff back to her mother. At this time, intelligence and statecraft was really mixed with the personal and the political intertwined seamlessly. And so she was sending back hundreds of letters, some of it including family gossip, who said what to whom. But then mixed in with that would be, here's some intentions of what the Prussian king is going to do. Here's some capabilities of his armies. So it was really, really great stuff. And it came about, she married the Crown Prince of Prussia, Fritz, as he was known in the family, and moved out to Prussia, moved in royal circles, had a seat at the top table in the land. And for a long time, she was able to send all this great stuff back to her mother. And as Richard says, Victoria was really worried about revolutionaries, about republicanism, about her own dynastic interests, but also about the physical safety of her relatives across the continent. Now, we need to remember that Vicky, the daughter, was one of many royal spies. Victoria had an informal royal intelligence network which spanned her friends and family and relatives all the way across the continent who were constantly writing stuff to her, bypassing the government, writing their own bits of intelligence to her, which meant that combined with Vicky, altogether, Victoria was impeccably placed. She knew so much stuff. She knew way more than the Foreign Office. She knew way more than Britain's, as they were then, informal amateur secret services. And how she chose to wield that knowledge was very, very delicate, because sometimes she'd share it. And she was the best, not only intelligence gatherer, but also intelligence analyst, because she knew the ins and outs of the royal families and the dynastic things and who was marrying whom and who disliked whom. She knew this way better than the prime ministers did. So she could help interpret it. But sometimes when the dynastic interests clashed with the foreign policy, she would withhold bits of information. She'd spin it. She'd cherry pick it to try and outmaneuver her own government and get her own way.
So some of, at a number of moments, the royal spy master, Victoria, is asking her spies to take significant risks. Vicky in Prussia sends about 4,000 letters back, but the Prussians know this is going on, and her nemesis is Bismarck, the German chancellor. Bismarck has set up a counter-espionage network. He's infiltrating spies into Vicky's royal household, and they're not subtle. They are looking at her correspondence, but they're also raiding her office and very visibly breaking into her letter drawer, breaking things around her room. It's scare tactics, saying to Victoria's daughter, "We're watching you. We know what you're doing, and we don't like it." So Victoria was asking her daughter to take some significant risks.
And because of this, the influence, the knowledge that Vicky has gradually gets squeezed over time because of Bismarck's spies and his intimidation. She starts off knowing all the secrets, but gradually, and she takes against Bismarck, she warns her mother furiously about the duplicity of Bismarck and the warmongering of Bismarck. And Bismarck, unsurprisingly, sees her as a British spy, turns against her, does all these intimidation tactics, and eventually squeezes her and her husband out of the inner circle. So Vicky becomes less useful. She tries writing in different codes, different ciphers that only her mother has access to. Again, even the Foreign Office couldn't read these things. But gradually she's got less and less useful information to give. And it's kind of a victory over a good few years, a victory to Bismarck in the end.
So by 1870, the Franco-Prussian War, Bismarck is actually doing successful deception via these conduits against Victoria.
So what was the British government's reaction to what Victoria was doing?
They liked having access to the intelligence. They didn't know quite how much she was manipulating and picking out the best bits, but it often brought them into conflict with her. There's a famous example would be the 1864 Schleswig-Holstein War, which is one of those 19th century European conflicts, which is terribly convoluted and complicated. I'll give you a famous quote that Palmerston gave at the outbreak of it, when he said there are only three men who knew the causes of the Schleswig-Holstein War. One was Prince Albert, and he is dead. One was a German professor, and he has gone mad. And the third was me, and I have forgotten. So it's one of those very complicated wars. But the important thing for us is that Vicky was providing her mother with intelligence about Prussian intentions, about the way the war was unfolding, the losses, the gains, detailed stuff about the weather, battle reports, all this kind of thing. And she was the best source. She was the best source. And Victoria, the Queen, used this intelligence to try to persuade the government not to support Denmark. The government, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary wanted to support Denmark against the Germans. Victoria, for dynastic reasons, did not want this to happen. And she used her intelligence, she used her channels, she used her best sources to outmaneuver and put pressure on the cabinet. And it won. she won. It worked. In the end, the foreign secretary, the prime minister, did a U-turn and decided not to militarily intervene. So there's a clear example of the Queen using her own royal intelligence to meddle, to manipulate, and to directly influence British foreign policy.
And actually, one of her children is married into the Danish royal family. So you see not only competition between Victoria and her government, you actually see competition between Victoria's own children over these spy networks. It's absolutely fascinating.
I think that's quite interesting, because I think we think that by the time Victoria's on the throne, she has very little to do with government and foreign policy. But actually, she stopped Britain being involved in a war, which is quite a big deal, really.
And this is what shocked me. I mean, I'll be honest, before we sat down to start researching this book, I didn't know a great deal about Queen Victoria. And my knowledge, like most people's, was limited to this image of the dowdy elderly woman dressed in black, locked herself away in Windsor, mourning for most of her reign. After the death of Albert. But it seems that actually couldn't be further from the truth, that she was meddling and manipulating and constantly hectoring prime ministers and foreign secretaries to do this, do that, give her more intelligence. She always wanted the latest material. And I think this is epitomised in a wonderful story quite late on in her reign, when she's meeting the incoming foreign secretary, a guy called Lord Rosebery. That's 1885, 86. He's inexperienced. He goes on to become prime minister, but at this point, he's inexperienced, a bit wet behind the ears. He goes to meet the Queen to get his seals of office. And she says to him, "Don't go to Mr. Gladstone. Don't go to the prime minister about these things. Come to me. I have the best intelligence sources. The cabinet don't make all the big decisions. Just come to me privately, because I frequently have intelligence of a very secret nature, which you might well be interested in." And when I read this, I was quite shocked, because it's showing the monarch bypassing the government to directly try to interfere with policy using her own secret sources. And I found that really quite striking.
And I think one of the things we've really enjoyed about the book is looking at two women who were really powerful in international relations. For the last 200 years, Britain's secret statecraft has largely been about Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth. It's two women at the top, not just passive recipients of intelligence, but real active practitioners of spying, practitioners of deception, practitioners of action. Absolutely fascinating.
So going back to before Victoria, European royal families were always intermarrying. Surely there would have been a bit of this before, where they would be passing information about royal courts to each other. Do we know much about this, if there was information shared?
Absolutely. There's hundreds of years of this. And what we see across Europe are the so-called black chambers. This is it's a very modern thing. It's the convergence of spying and science and mathematics. And most of the European monarchs maintained these mini Bletchley parks, where people who were really good at maths were brought in and they were breaking each other's communications. And in Britain, there's a family that over 200-300 years provides most of the mathematicians. They're coming from Cambridge or Oxford, but they're working for the crown. And they are, as I say, they're a precursor to, and actually the people at GCHQ now venerate these people as they're essentially the originators of their statecraft.
So could you tell me a bit about Lord Granville? So he was the Lord President of the Council, and he apparently would tell the Queen opinions from the ministers in her government. Could this have had serious consequences for him?
Well, not only does she have royal spies around Europe, she even has a spy inside cabinet. And he's not only kind of telling her the broad discussions of cabinet, which she would get anyway in the official minutes and memoranda. He's telling her individual opinions held by individual ministers, which she then uses as she's trying to put pressure over different foreign policy issues. And there's a string of examples where she uses the knowledge gleaned about different ministers' views to try to manipulate foreign policy. The Schleswig-Holstein example is just one. You've also got the Prussian-Austrian War a few years later. You've got the Franco-Prussian War. And all the time, she is using her sources in cabinet. She's using her sources on the continent. She's acting as a DIY intelligence analyst and then trying to shape things. Interestingly, not only did she have her own spies in the cabinet, she also accused the foreign secretary's wife, Lady Derby, of leaking secrets to the Russians at one point. So she was worried that whilst she was happily taking leaks from her side, she was very worried about leaks going to another side. She took this very seriously. Badgering and hectoring and shouting at people to the extent that polite society were quite worried that Queen Victoria was going quite mad at one point as her Russophobia got the better of her, and she's hectoring poor Lady Derby for leaking secrets to the Russians. So it's intrigue abounds, I think, is the conclusion of all this. There's so much intrigue, discreet diplomacy, spying, leaks. And she's right in the thick of it. And quite frankly, she loves it.
And what Victoria really loves is a kind of 007 James Bond figure with twirling moustaches. And this particular instance is about a guy called Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Wellesley. He's a relative of the Duke of Wellington. He's a master spy in Moscow. He's really good at borrowing secret papers from Russian ministries, copying them, sending them back to London. And this is the stuff that leaks out. It leaks out, we think, perhaps through Lady Derby. It goes to the French ambassador. It goes to the Russian ambassador. And in no time at all, Wellesley is outed in Moscow as Victoria's spy. And Victoria is absolutely incandescent with rage. And she's waging a private war against the foreign secretary and his wife on behalf of her flamboyant 007 agent in Moscow.
So today the monarchy is supposed to be neutral. Was the same supposed to apply for Victoria?
Absolutely not. So clearly Queen Victoria is pursuing several quite political campaigns. As Rory says, it's partly about her Russophobia, but our other big political campaign is against leftists and anarchists and subversives. So in the 19th century, Britain has this fantastic tradition of providing political asylum, of providing refuge for all sorts of figures, nationalists like Mazzini, leftists like Karl Marx. London was kind of a menagerie of some of Europe's most colourful political figures. Queen Victoria hated this. All her relatives are writing to her from Europe saying, why are you hosting all these terrible people? And so there's a constant battle between her and people like Palmerston, people who are radically liberal. They want to support these revolutionaries. Victoria doesn't like it.
And at one point, Palmerston sanctions a covert operation where they're secretly funneling arms to Sicilian rebels fighting against the Italian king. And Victoria goes absolutely nuts. And it's this constant fight. And she's getting letters from her relatives talking about assassinations, saying so-and-so has just died, so-and-so has been stabbed, so-and-so is in the hands of the mob. And she's worried about this. And doesn't mince her words. At one point, she says, these evil Republicans must be exterminated. She doesn't mince her words at all. And that is clearly very, very different context historically and constitutionally from the world in which Queen Elizabeth reigns now. And it started to change after Queen Victoria. Edward VII was a bit disappointed he didn't quite have his mother's influence, and gradually it becomes more what we know today. But under Victoria, no, she was very happy and willing to meddle and manipulate and interfere.
It's remarkably modern in the sense that for 50 years through her reign, Victoria's fighting this political battle over issues of asylum, issues of human rights, issues of political liberty. All the way through her reign, she's trying to promote European-style secret policing. She wants revolutionaries in Britain to be put under close surveillance, and she also wants their rights to be changed. So every 10 years, a new piece of legislation is introduced into Parliament to try and throw these people out. Even in her last decade, in 1894, she's bringing in something called the Aliens Act. But once again, every 10 years, it's defeated. The British Parliament will not roll back on their liberal, inclusive agenda of welcoming these revolutionaries from Europe. Victoria hates it.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
They never got any response. At one point, they said, oh, do you really want this stuff? Shouldn't we stop? And immediately, Buckingham Palace said, no, we love this stuff. Send us more stories. This is what we read over the breakfast table. So you know, the Windsor Archive is a wonderful place. And one day, perhaps, its secrets will be open to the British public.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
So were the public aware at all of how much Victoria was getting involved? And if they were, what did they think?
No, they were. This all happened behind closed doors. They worried at one point that Albert was a spy. He wasn't. And there was propaganda kind of whipped it up a little bit. And they ended up protesting outside Tower of London for Albert's head, which, as you can imagine, really, really annoyed Queen Victoria. But most of it took place behind closed doors. And to give perhaps the most famous example, in 1844, there was a big scandal about surveillance over the exact kind of issues that Richard just been outlining, when a nationalist guy called Giuseppe Mazzini, who had been trying to foment revolutions on the continent, was hiding out in London, was convinced that the Brits were spying on him, were opening his letters, reading them, and resealing them, which they were. To catch out the British doing this, he sneakily put a poppy seed, a grain of sand, and a strand of hair inside one of these envelopes, and he posted it to himself. And sure enough, it came in the post, he opened it up, and the telltale contents had fallen out because somebody somewhere had opened it and read it. Now he was appalled. He went public. The MPs were completely appalled, the members of parliament. So this was so thoroughly un-British. This was like those naughty secret policemen, the Fouchés on the continent, which we just don't do with political police. All the while, Victoria, in private, is saying, hang on, it's not, this isn't so bad. Bearing in mind, one, she's been reading this stuff all her life. She's been intercepting everyone else's letters. And she writes all this stuff in a diary. She says, you know, today I intercepted X's letter. It was quite funny. Today I intercepted Y's letter. I learned this. So for her, this is quite normal. And she doesn't see a problem with it because she's being lobbied by her relatives that Britain needs to do much more to clamp down on people like Mazzini. So behind the scenes, she's offering support to the Home Secretary. She doesn't go public. I think she prefers to operate in the shadows almost and use that influence cautiously and carefully. Hence why the public image of her was always the woman locked away at Windsor grieving. And that shows that public-private. The public image was one of the sad widow, but in private she's manipulating, she's meddling, and nowhere is that more epitomized than in the Mazzini affair.
And Victoria's treading on slightly delicate territory here, because of course spying, authoritarianism, this is something that's associated with the absolutist monarchs of Europe, with Frederick of Prussia, Joseph of Austria. And of course, the British royal family isn't British. And there's this idea that, you know, people like Victoria, people like Albert, want to introduce these un-British European spying methods into the wonderful liberal British polity. There's quite a lot of tension there.
So as you just said, Victoria was a fan of opening other people's letters. Did she do this with her own family? Was she reading Albert's letters?
Well, Albert's kind of position in all this is really fascinating, because, you know, Albert and Victoria marry in 1840, and when Albert and Victoria marry, Albert is initially frozen out. So all these boxes of secret material are coming to Victoria, and Victoria's just like, no, you don't see this stuff. But Albert is really efficient. He's meticulous. He's kind of the perfect private secretary. And gradually he's drawn in. Gradually he becomes more important. And particularly during the Crimean War, because Albert has military knowledge that Victoria doesn't have. And he becomes absolutely indispensable. He effectively becomes a one-person war cabinet for Victoria.
And it's also triggered by her pregnancies as well. His way in was when she was heavily pregnant and struggling to deal with all the papers and boxes herself. And that's when she started to rely on him a little bit more. She had this very... She struggled with that because, as Richard says, she didn't want to let him in at first. And it was only when she kind of had to. And then she realised how important and helpful he was, but there's no evidence of her reading his letters. She read various relatives' letters, but ones on the continent, King Leopold of the Belgians, for example, she read his letters, and one occasion saw that he was slagging her off, which didn't go down very well. But I've not seen any evidence that she read her kind of closest family members' letters.
So I believe that when her son, Prince Alfred, he married into the Russian royal family, but he failed to be a useful spy in the Russian court. So then Victoria turned to an army officer, Frederick Burnaby. Can you tell me a bit about him? He sounds quite interesting.
He was one of those classic Victorian era soldier, come adventurer, come spy, come all round interesting character. And she found these men who operated on the frontiers of empire in the Great Game really, really interesting, because she was used to being given all the best stuff. She was used to having the best sources and outmaneuvering her own government. When it came to Germany and Europe, she was number one. Unfortunately, this all collapsed when it came to imperial matters and the Great Game and India and Russia and Afghanistan, when she hoped she'd have a source inside the Russian royal family. But the marriage was never as happy as Fritz and Vicky's. They didn't spend as much time in the Russian court. He passed on the odd interesting little bit, but nowhere near the 4,000 wonderful letters that Vicky sent. So Victoria casts her net slightly more widely, and finds this Burnaby chap just so interesting. He's going across the outer fringes of empire on horseback, writing books, seeing Russian military maneuvers, judging the mood in frontier towns, what tribes can be subverted, who can be bribed, what are the Russians up to, how secure is empire? And he reports back to the queen. He's one of many that she invites back to Windsor to regale her with these stories of spies and horseback riding across snowy mountains. You can just picture her sitting at the dinner table, just having a great time.
I think this is, as Rory says, this is to some extent when Victoria's spy network goes bad. It's when the wonderful stuff from the royal network runs out. She turns to these kind of Lord Flashheart characters, people who are famous for riding across Central Asia backwards on a camel. Burnaby was a pioneer balloonist with twirling mustachios. And, you know, they're flamboyant spies. They come back from a spying mission. The first thing they do is write a memoir saying how they've stabbed a few Russians. And Victoria loves this, but it is a diplomatic disaster. And it's also about the politicization of intelligence. Victoria is less concerned about the accuracy of the narrative. What she loves is some good anti-Russian stories. If you've got good Russophobia, Victoria is all over it.
This might be quite a tricky question to answer, but if Victoria had lived a little bit longer, do you think her kind of love of espionage might have altered the course of the First World War?
That is a good question. It's one we've never been asked before. Let me think. So she had excellent networks on Germany. But this was dwindling. This was dwindling. So I think the fact that Vicky had been frozen out, this wasn't, you know, the 1850s, 1860s anymore. So probably not, because her intelligence network, if she'd been around in 1910, 11, 12, wasn't as good as it was in the 1860s. So I'm going to say no.
And I'm going to say yes, because Victoria absolutely, personally, had the measure of the Kaiser. So she had great emotional intelligence. She knew what the Kaiser loved. The young Kaiser loved dressing up. The more flamboyant, the better. And the Kaiser, as a young man, turns up at Balmoral for Christmas, and Victoria has prepared for him a special uniform in yellow tartan. And you've never seen the Kaiser more happy. So there was this kind of... The Kaiser was a difficult figure. Most of the members of the royal families in Europe found him awkward to deal with. But Victoria got on really well with him and understood him. Perhaps there would have been a personal connection.
So did Edward VII continue using his own intelligence like his mother?
He tried, but he was really irritated that he wasn't quite as trusted as his mother. His mother had been on the throne for half a century. She had wonderful networks. She was experienced. Edward comes along, and as Prince of Wales, he's seen as a bit of a liability. And there's blackmail hanging over him. He's been cavorting around the sordid Parisian underworld. He's a bit of a security risk, a playboy prince. And when he comes in, the Foreign Office, the Prime Minister, are not as keen to trust him with the greatest secrets of state as they were with his mother, who had spent literally half a century doing this stuff. So he does have some networks. He has various family members. He has a high society set. He's friends with people who know stuff. And it's very, very informal. But he's not embedded in it as a head of almost like an informal intelligence network in quite the same way as his mother. Partly because she built up for 50 years. And partly because he wasn't seen as trustworthy. He was a bit loose-lipped.
So skipping forward a bit to probably like the pinnacle of espionage of the Second World War, how involved was George VI with the intelligent work that was going on?
So George VI initially is a little bit distrusted by the intelligence services. He's been a real enthusiast for appeasement. And of course, his brother has abdicated. as soon as his brother Edward abdicated, he nipped off to Germany in 1937 to have tea with Hitler. Not a good sign, really. So there's a little bit of anxiety in 1939. But very quickly, George VI demonstrates his credentials, partly because during the Battle of Britain, he makes it very clear that unlike other European monarchs, he's not going to cut and run. He's going to fight. Actually, the royal family are all practicing with weapons in the gardens of Buckingham Palace, ready to shoot their German paratroopers. This is genuine, but it's also theatre. It's sending out a message to people like the American ambassador in London. We are not going to run. We are going to stand and fight. So send us lend-lease and support us. So this is all really quite important.
Have you got any good examples of when some royal intelligence has been bungled?
I'll go back to Victoria while Richard has a think. My example will be the Franco-Prussian War, when Victoria still has pretty good networks. Vicky's still sending her stuff back saying Bismarck is agitating for a conflict with France. He's setting it all up. He's laying the groundwork. He is the aggressor here. He's the bad guy. Victoria gets all this, and she's normally a very astute intelligence consumer and analyst. But on this occasion, she fluffs it up completely because she lets her Francophobia get on top of her. One country she hates more than the Russians, and it's the French. So even though she's got impeccable sources saying Bismarck's doing this, don't listen to the Foreign Office, they're getting it wrong, Bismarck, she thinks, nah, it must be the French to being the aggressors here. That's the kind of thing the French would do. This rampant Francophobia is colouring her judgment, so she completely ignores outstanding intelligence and gets it horribly wrong. And that's as clear-cut an example of a royal intelligence blunder that I can think of.
I think the most frequent royal intelligence blunder is not in terms of intelligence, but their communication security. So something which, you know, generations of royals have been told about is be careful of the telephone. Regard the telephone as like a coiled rattlesnake. But it's very difficult to live your life without communication, because the telephone, letters is how you contact friends. Being a royal is often quite a kind of lonely existence. And the classic example of this is Edward VIII. Edward VIII knows he's being listened to by armies of journalists and every secret service in the world. And after a while, he just says, you know, I can't be doing with this. I'm just going to say what I think. I'm just going to behave how I want to. And there's a marvellous moment immediately before the abdication in 1936 when Edward is trying to conspire with his closest friends, Churchill, Lloyd George, people like Max Beaverbrook, the press baron. They all know they're being listened into. So Edward will pick up the phone at night and try and talk about conspiracy. And all his friends were completely horrified because they knew MI5, MI6, the world's press, the French, they were all listening in. And you can just imagine their faces. But Edward VIII didn't care. He just got on with it.
So both the Secret Service and the monarchy are incredibly private and close guarded. How easy was it for you to research this book?
It was incredibly, incredibly difficult. We are historians of espionage, of secret statecraft, if you like, and we've been dealing with trying to write histories of the secret services for our entire career. But in comparison, goodness me, the royal family makes MI6 look like WikiLeaks. They really guard their secrets very, very closely. There is nothing, practically nothing, in the National Archives about the royal family. They meet, the monarch meets the Prime Minister every week. There's no record of these meetings. There's not even any minutes taken. And when we were sitting in queue at the National Archives, I found a file about the royal meeting, the prime ministerial meeting on a Tuesday. And I thought, oh my goodness, has one actually slipped through the net? Am I going to get an insight into what the monarch and prime minister discuss? I eagerly called this file up, opened the dusty jacket, and inside it literally just was said, would the palace mind if Harold Macmillan wears tails tonight to meet the Queen? And that was it. And I think that gives a sense of the barren landscape in which we had to work.
So all the best secrets are in the Royal Archive at Windsor, and this is a place that material is continually flowing into, but not, it's like a black hole. Things are sucked in, but they never go out. But one of the duties of the British embassies around the world is to report on stories about the monarchy, send them in to London, send them to Buckingham Palace. One of the hotspots for this was the British Embassy in France, because the French press absolutely love the British monarchy. And they're always doing crazy stories about how Princess Anne had the whole Everton football team in her bedroom, how the Queen Mother had died and had been replaced by a body double. All this stuff was being sent in by junior diplomats in British diplomats in France through the 70s and the 80s. And they never got any response. At one point they said, oh, do you really want this stuff? Shouldn't we stop? And immediately Buckingham Palace said, no, we love this stuff. Send us more stories. This is what we read over the breakfast table. So you know, the Windsor Archive is a wonderful place, and one day perhaps its secrets will be open to the British public.
That was Richard J. Aldrich and Rory Cormack. Richard is Professor of International Security at the University of Warwick. And Rory is Professor of International Relations at the University of Nottingham. The Secret Royals, Spying in the Crown from Victoria to Diana, is out now, published by Atlantic Books. They've also written an article on Queen Victoria and espionage in the January issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.